Competence. Storytelling. Through storytelling, outlining a huge vision, Amazon has reshaped the relationship between company and shareholder. The story is told via media outlets, especially those covering business and tech. Many of them have decided tech CEOs are the new celebrities, and they give Amazon the spotlight, center stage, and star billing anytime. Until now, the contract companies have with shareholders is, give us a few years and tens of millions of dollars, and then we'll begin returning capital to you in the form of profits. Amazon has exploded this tradition, replacing profits with vision and growth via storytelling. The story is compelling and simple, the power couple of messaging. The story, Earth's biggest store. The strategy, huge investments in consumer benefits that stand the test of time, lower cost, greater selection, and faster delivery. Thanks to a rate of growth that reflects a steady march toward this vision, the market bids Amazon stock higher and provides the firm with exceptionally cheap capital. Most retailers trade at a multiple of profits times 8. By comparison, Amazon trades at a multiple of 40. In addition, Amazon has trained the street to hold them to a different standard, to expect higher growth but lower profits. That enables the company to take these substantial incremental gross margin dollars it earns each year and plow more capital back into the business, and avoid that whole tax thing. And that in turn funds the digging of deeper and deeper moats around the business. Profits are to investors what heroin is to an addict. Investors love profits. I mean, really love them. Yes, invest, grow, and innovate, but don't dare get in the way of me getting jacked up on skag. Profits. Amazon's revolutionary timeline of capital allocation is what has been preached for generations in business school. Total disregard for the short-term needs of investors in pursuit of long-term goals. A company that does this is as rare as a young adult who skips prom to study. Normal business thinking. If we can borrow money at historically low rates, buy back stock, and see the value of management's options increase, why invest in growth and the jobs that come with it? That's risky. Amazon business thinking. If we can borrow money at historically low rates, why don't we invest that money in extraordinarily expensive control delivery systems? That way, we secure an impregnable position in retail and asphyxiate our competitors. Then, we can get really big fast. Walmart wants to impress its parents and is earnestly investing for the long term. But the markets don't buy this maturity from the Bentonville firm. On Walmart's Q1 2016 earnings call, management informed the street that the company would be substantially increasing technology capital expenditures to win the future of retail. This was the correct and only choice for Walmart. However, the strategy meant a reduction in projected earnings. Cue the withdrawals and vomiting. Within 20 minutes of the opening of trading the following day, Walmart's market value shed the equivalent of 2.5 Macy's, $20 billion. Being an investor in Amazon is growing up in Mitt Romney's house. You're just not going to get access to heroin. Profits. Through earnings call after earnings call, Amazon reinforces its vision of growth, downplays profits, and reminds its shareholders that it doesn't ever pay dividends. The ointment is a vision of world domination, complete with cool new technologies, drones, content, movies, and Star Trek tricorders, Amazon Echo, that have more adoption and buzz than any consumer hardware product since the iPad. It's storytelling, but in a Harry Potter way, where the next story is better than the original. Cheap capital leads to 100-time risks. Shrewdly and publicly, Mr. Bezos bifurcates Amazon's risk-taking into two types. One, those you can't walk back from. This is the future of the company. And two, those you can. This isn't working, we're out of here. Bezos's view is that it's key to Amazon's investment strategy to take on many Type 2 experiments, including a flying warehouse or systems that protect drones from bow and arrow. They've filed patents for both. Type 2 investments are cheap because they likely will be killed before they waste too much money, and they pay big dividends in image building as a leading-edge company. Shareholders love these stories. It makes them feel like they're part of an exciting adventure. Plus, every once in a while, they actually pan out, and when they do, Amazon has the fuel, capital, to pour on the spark and start a firestorm that sears the competition. The overlooked lesson here, other than having a shit ton of capital, is the willingness to perform infanticide on initiatives or products that aren't working, thus freeing up capital, in Amazon's case human capital, to start new crazy initiatives. My experience in traditional firms is that anything new is seen as innovative, and the people assigned to it, like any parent, become irrationally passionate about the project and refuse to acknowledge just how stupid and ugly your little project has become. As a result, traditional companies not only have less capital to invest, but fewer swings at the plate. Amazon demonstrates real discipline around not ramping investment until they know something is working. For all the hype over the last 3 years about Amazon's entry into brick-and-mortar retail, the sum of their efforts is around 24 stores. They haven't found a format they feel they can scale. Bezos, like any great leader, has the ability to explain a crazy idea in a way that makes it seem less crazy but practical. Wait, that's obvious. How did we not think of that? The really crazy shit isn't stupid, it's bold. Yeah, a floating warehouse sounds crazy the first time you hear of it. Now, ponder the cost of leasing and running a traditional terrestrial warehouse. What are its biggest expenses? Proximity and rent, respectively. Now, think again about a floating warehouse. Not so crazy, right? Bezos's perpetual message is that it's Amazon's nature to swing for the fences on a regular basis. But the analogy is wrong. In baseball, a grand slam only scores 4 runs. By comparison, the home runs of Amazon Prime and AWS produced several thousand runs when the Seattle firm connected with the ball. As Bezos wrote in Amazon's first annual letter in 1997, given a 10% chance of 100 times payout, you should take that bet every time. Needless to say, most CEOs don't think this way. Most won't even take risks that have less than a 50% chance of success, no matter how big the potential payoff. This is a big reason why old economy firms are leaking value to new economy firms. Today's successful companies may have the assets, cash flow, and brand equity, but they approach risk differently than many tech firms that have seen their death. They live for today, and acknowledge that great success only comes with significant, even existential, risk. There is a survivor bias that plagues old economy CEOs and their shareholders. My nightmare job is the invisible until you fuck up position. These jobs are everywhere. IT, corporate treasurer, auditor, air traffic controller, nuclear power plant operator, county elevator inspector, TSA officer. You'll never be famous, but you have a small and terrifying chance of being infamous. CEOs of successful old economy firms have a similar bias. They are rich until they fuck up. CEO pay has become so crazy that on a risk-adjusted basis, you're better off staying out of traffic, logging your 6 to 8 years, and retiring rich. However, if you Google biggest mistakes in business history, the majority of results are risks that firms failed to take, such as Excite and Blockbuster passing on acquiring Google and Netflix, respectively. History favors the bold. Compensation favors the meek. As a Fortune 500 company CEO, you're better off taking the path often traveled and staying the course. Big companies may have more assets to innovate with, but they rarely take big risks or innovate at the cost of cannibalizing a current business. Neither would they chance alienating suppliers or investors. They play not to lose, and shareholders reward them for it. until those shareholders walk and buy Amazon stock. Most boards ask management, how can we build the greatest advantage for the least amount of capital or investment? Amazon reverses the question. What can we do that gives us an advantage that's hugely expensive and that no one else can afford? Why? Because Amazon has access to capital with lower return expectations than peers. Reducing shipping times from 2 days to 1 day? That will require billions. Amazon will have to build smart warehouses near cities, where real estate and labor are expensive. By any conventional measure, it would be a huge investment for a marginal return. But for Amazon, it's all kinds of perfect. Why? Because Macy's, Sears, and Walmart can't afford to spend billions getting the delivery times of their relatively small online businesses down from 2 days to one. Consumers love it, and competitors stand flaccid on the sidelines. In 2015, Amazon spent $7 billion on shipping fees, a net shipping loss of $5 billion, and overall profits of $2.4 billion. Crazy, no? No. Amazon is going underwater with the world's largest oxygen tank, forcing other retailers to follow it, match its prices, and deal with changed customer delivery expectations. The difference is other retailers have just the air in their lungs and are drowning. Amazon will surface and have the ocean of retail largely to itself. Making Type 2 investments also desensitizes Amazon shareholders to failure. All of the four share this. Look at Apple and Google with their not-so-secret autonomous vehicle projects, and Facebook with its regular introduction of new features to further monetize its users, which it then pulls back when the experiments don't pan out. Remember Lighthouse? As Bezos also wrote in that first annual letter, failure and invention are inseparable twins. To invent, you have to experiment. And if you know in advance that it's going to work, it's not an experiment. Red, white, and blue. The four are all disciplined about getting out in front of their skis, taking big, bold, smart bets, and tolerating failure. This failure gene is at the heart of Amazon's and, more broadly, the U.S. economy's success. I've founded or co-founded 9 firms, and I'm generously 3-4-2, win-loss-tie. No other society would tolerate, much less reward me. America is the land of second chances, and even if Jeff Bezos is predictably globalist, the culture at Amazon is distinctly red, white, and blue. Most uber-wealthy people have one thing in common. Failure. They've experienced it, usually in spades, as the path to wealth is fraught with risks. And often those risks end up being, well, risky. A society that encourages you to get up after being beamed in the head, dust off your pants, step back into the batter's box, and swing harder the next time is the secret sauce for printing billionaires. The correlation is clear. America has the most lenient bankruptcy laws, attracts risk-takers, and, as you might guess, has most of them. 29 of the 50 wealthiest people on the planet live in the United States, and 2/3 of unicorns, private companies with $1 billion-plus valuations, are headquartered here. Sell the picks. Just as it's better to own the land under a mine, it's also good business to sell picks to the miners. The California Gold Rush proved that was true 170 years ago. Amazon proves it's still true today. Amazon owns a lucrative mine. The firm divides its revenue between retail sales of consumer products, Amazon itself and Amazon Marketplace, and other, the group that holds ad sales from Amazon Media Group and its cloud services, AWS. Most e-commerce firms can never get to profitability, and at some point, investors tire of a vision that's reheated Bezos. The firm gets sold, Gilt, Haute Look, Red Envelope, or Shutters, Boo.com, Fab, Style.com. a combination of a winner-take-all ecosystem, accelerating customer acquisition, last-mile costs, and a generally inferior online experience make pure-play e-commerce untenable. Amazon doesn't escape this fact. But even if Amazon's core business, pure-play e-commerce, is a difficult one for turning a profit, the immense value Amazon has delivered to consumers has created the most trusted and reputable consumer brand on the planet. Amazon has dominated e-commerce sales volume, but its business model isn't easily replicated or sustained. These days, it's easy to forget that Amazon did not turn its first profit until Q4 2001, 7 years after its founding, and has dipped in and out of profitability ever since. In the past few years, Amazon has traded on this brand equity, leveraging it to extend into other businesses, and has expanded into other, simply better, more profitable businesses. Looking back, Amazon's retail platform just may have been the Trojan horse that established the relationships and brand later monetized with other businesses. While year-to-year growth for Amazon's retail business ranged from 13% to 20% from Q1 to Q3 2015, Amazon Web Services, the retailer's network of servers and data storage technology, has grown 49% to 81% during that same interval. AWS also grew into a significant portion of Amazon's total operating income, from 38% in Q1 2015 to 52% in Q3 2015. Analysts predict that AWS could reach $16.2 billion in sales by the end of 2017, making it worth $160 billion, more than the company's retail unit. In other words, while the world still thinks of Amazon as a retailer, it has quietly become a cloud company, the world's biggest. And Amazon isn't stopping at web hosting. Amazon Media Group alone will likely soon surpass Twitter's 2016 revenue of $2.5 billion, making it one of the largest online media properties. Amazon Prime, the most non-exclusive club in America, 44% of U.S. households, is offering for $99 a year, 2-day free shipping, 2-hour shipping on select products, Amazon Now, and music and video streaming, including original content. Ideas for content are given the budget for a pilot, and then viewers are asked to vote online for which series get greenlighted. Amazon, like any sovereign superpower, pursues a triad strategy: air, land, and sea. Can you, Mr. Retailer, get your stuff to your consumer within an hour? No problem. Amazon can do it for you, for a fee. Because it's making the investment you can't afford to make. Warehouses run by robots near city centers. Dedicated cargo planes and trucks. Each day, 4 Boeing 767 cargo planes carry goods from Tracy, California, via an airport in nearby Stockton that was half the size 3 years ago, to a 1-million-square-foot warehouse that didn't even exist until last year. In early 2016, Amazon was given a license by the Federal Maritime Commission to implement ocean freight services as an ocean transportation intermediary. So, Amazon can now ship others' goods. This new service, dubbed Fulfillment by Amazon, FBA, won't do much directly for individual consumers, but it will allow Amazon's Chinese partners to more easily and cost-effectively get their products across the Pacific in containers. Want to bet how long it will take Amazon to dominate oceanic transport business? The market to ship stuff, mostly across the Pacific, is a $350 billion business, but a low-margin one. Shippers charge $1,300 to ship a 40-foot container holding up to 10,000 units of product, 13 cents per unit, or just under $10 to deliver a flat-screen TV. It's a down-and-dirty business, unless you're Amazon. The biggest component of that cost comes from labor, unloading and loading the ships and the paperwork. Amazon can deploy hardware, robotics, and software to reduce these costs. Combined with the company's fledgling aircraft fleet, this could prove another huge business for Amazon. Between drones, 757 767s, tractor trailers, trans-Pacific shipping, and retired military generals, no joke, who oversaw the world's most complex logistics operations, try supplying submarines and aircraft carriers that don't surface or dock more than once every 6 months, Amazon is building the most robust logistics infrastructure in history. If you're like me, this can only leave you in awe. I can't even make sure I have Gatorade in the fridge when I need it. Stores. The final brick in Amazon's strategy for world domination is its use of shitloads of assets piled up online to conquer the retail landscape offline. That's right. I mean stores. Those things that were supposed to perish thanks to e-commerce. The truth is that the death of physical stores has been vastly overstated. In fact, it's not stores that are dying, but the middle class. And, in turn, the businesses that serve that once great cohort and its neighborhoods. The largest mall owner in the United States is Simon Property Group. Its shareholders have been hit hard in 2017 after hitting an all-time high in 2016. However, Simon will likely be fine, as it sold properties in middle and lower income neighborhoods to focus on wealthy neighborhoods. 44% of total U.S. mall value, based on sales, size, and quality, among other measures, now resides with the top 100 properties, out of about 1,000 malls. Taubman Properties, another owner of high-end malls, reports tenants averaged sales per square foot of $800 in 2015, up 57% since 2005. Compare that to CBL and Associates Properties Incorporated, which operates B and C malls. Its sales per square foot rose just 13% to $374 during that same period. So, stores are here to stay. If we are careful what stores we're talking about. But so is e-commerce. Ultimately, the real winners will be those retailers who understand how to integrate both. Amazon aims to be that company. The next retail age will be coined the multi-channel era, a time when integration across web, social, and brick and mortar is crucial to success. Everything points to Amazon dominating that era as well. I've said for a while that Amazon will open stores, lots of them. It makes sense for them to acquire either a struggling retailer, like Macy's, or a company with a large footprint and vascular system, like a convenience store franchise. Amazon's greatest expense is shipping, and their highest objective is to reach more and more households in less and less time. This is why it made sense for Amazon to acquire Whole Foods, a 460-store franchise that will give Amazon a physical presence in urban centers, where affluent, fast-to-reach consumers live. Amazon has had a decade of selling groceries online without much success, as customers prefer to buy produce and meat in person. Key to success in the multi-channel era is knowing which channel to optimize, and how to cater to our hunter-gatherer instincts. As of this writing, in addition to the Whole Foods acquisition, Amazon is testing its own grocery stores in Seattle and the San Francisco Bay Area. It now has bookstores in Seattle, Chicago, and New York City, with others planned for San Diego, Portland, and New Jersey. Why does Amazon, bookstore killer, need brick-and-mortar bookstores? To sell the Echo, Kindle, and its other goods. Customers want to see, touch, and feel products, Amazon's chief financial officer Brian Olsavsky admitted. The firm is also testing a dozen pop-up retail stores, with a total of perhaps 100 planned by the end of 2017, targeted at U.S. malls. This is happening even as venerable retailers Macy's and Sears, including its Kmart chain, and mall giants JCPenney and Kohl's have announced plans to shutter hundreds of stores in 2017. Meanwhile, to get a leg up in the multi-channel era, brick-and-mortar behemoth Walmart spent $3.3 billion to buy Amazon competitor Jet.com in what feels like a corporate midlife crisis and $3.3 billion hair plugs. Walmart was frustrated they weren't making progress in online sales, and their frustration was justified. As Amazon marched on, Walmart's e-commerce sales growth had slowed, even flattened. Jet.com shows that the difference between a dot bomb and a unicorn is a huckster versus a visionary, respectively. How can you tell the difference? One has had an exit or liquidity event. Mark Lurie, Jet's founder, is that visionary or huckster. Mr. Lurie is Jeff Bezos's brother by another mother. Or if you're a retail worker, they are the spawn of Ayn Rand and Darwin, raised by Darth Maul. Lurie is also a banker who turned to e-commerce and chose a low consideration category that, even better than books, had replenishment built in. Diapers. In 2005, Lurie started diapers.com and launched several other categories for parents under the corporate umbrella Quidsi. When Bezos toured the firm, he must have felt at home, recognizing the warehouses close to urban centers staffed by Kiva robots standing behind a site run by algorithms. Bezos fell hard, and in 2011 paid $545 million for Quidsi. For $500 million, Amazon bought momentum in key categories, got some great human capital, and took a competitor off the market. But Lurie didn't want to work for Jeff Bezos, he wanted to be Jeff Bezos. 24 months later, he bolted, and with his new wealth, started Jet.com. This must have felt like a $500 million divorce settlement to your husband, who then moves into the house next door and starts fucking your friends. The ex is still pissed off. In April 2017, Bezos closed Quidsi and laid off many of its employees. Hey, if you leave me, your brother needs to move out of the basement. Maybe Quidsi should have been shut down. But my bet is this was Jeff saying to Mark, and fuck you too. We forget most of the world's major organizations are run by humans, middle-aged humans, who have enormous egos that ensure they, on a regular basis, make an emotional or a rational decision. Jet uses algorithms to encourage you to increase the size of your basket by lowering the price based on cost of shipping and how profitable the bundle is. It has an annual membership fee of $50, similar to Wholesale Club Costco. This was the first company that had the balls to take on Amazon head-to-head, and in its first year raised $250 million. But there was a glitch. The firm and offering made no sense. Jet.com announced soon after launch that they were scrapping the membership model, as business was so strong without it. This is the PR equivalent of turning chicken shit into chicken salad. At the time of Walmart's acquisition, Jet.com was spending $4 million a week on advertising and needed to get to $20 billion in annual sales, more revenue than Whole Foods or Nordstrom, to break even. As traditional consumer marketing wanes in importance at the hands of digital, and better products emerge that consumers can discover using new tools of diligence, entrepreneurs' ability to spin lemons into lemonade to raise ridiculous amounts of capital, position themselves as disruptive, and sell to an old economy firm hysterical over its deepening crow's feet, is the new marketing. While Walmart attempts to bolt on an e-commerce operation to its existing physical retail infrastructure, Amazon is building and acquiring stores to complement its robust online retail, and is likely to win as a result. Consumers increasingly prefer a channel-agnostic experience, where digital, specifically your smartphone, serves as the connective tissue between consumer, store, and site. The consumer always wins, and she has a choice. Door 1, a great e-commerce experience. Door 2, a great in-store experience. Or door 3, a great site and store experience connected by her mobile phone. The ability to reserve something on her phone, pick it up in store, buy online, exchange it in store, and never have to wait in a checkout line is damn near unbeatable. Sephora, Home Depot, and department stores already have this kind of multi-channel integration. the future of retail may currently look more like Sephora than Amazon in its current form. However, Amazon has the assets, capital, technology, trust, unrivaled investment in last-mile fulfillment, to realize the multi-channel dreams of consumers and help other retailers get there for a price as well. Ultimately, then, why should Amazon, the king of online retail, get into multi-channel retail? Because e-commerce doesn't work, isn't economically viable, and no pure e-commerce firm will survive long-term. On the front end of the e-commerce channel, the cost of customer acquisition continues to rise as consumers' loyalty to brands erodes. You have to keep reacquiring them. In 2004, 47% of affluent consumers could name a favorite retail brand. 6 years later, that number dropped to 28%. That makes a pure e-commerce play increasingly dangerous. Nobody wants to be at the mercy of Google and disloyal consumers. Amazon has decided it wants off the merry-go-round of high-price acquisition coupled with zero loyalty. That's why the company, via pricing and exclusive content and products, is asking people either to join Amazon Prime or leave. Prime members represent recurring revenue, loyalty, and annual purchases that are 140% greater than non-Prime members. If Prime continues to grow at its current rate, and people continue to cut the cord, within the next 8 years, more households will have Amazon Prime memberships than cable television. In addition, the cost to build out a robust multi-channel offering, which is rapidly becoming the table stakes for survival in retail, is painfully difficult and expensive. Cue Amazon, whose infrastructure is, effectively, building the cable pipe of stuff into the world's wealthiest households. 70% of U.S. high-income households have Prime. Amazon's storefronts will effectively be warehouses that support Amazon's and other retailers' last-mile problem. The cost to get you that little black dress from a warehouse to a truck to a plane to a truck to your house, where you're not home, come back the next day, where you try it on, and decide to have a guy in a brown uniform take it back to his truck, to a plane, to a truck, to the warehouse, is very expensive. Amazon's fulfillment costs have grown 50% since Q1 2012. That's not sustainable, unless Amazon can garner membership fees and charge others to use its infrastructure, which is exactly where the company is headed. At the apex of its power, Walmart never had its own planes or drones. Overnight delivery firms, FedEx, DHL, and UPS, have raised their prices an average of 83% over the last decade. And since the advent of tracking 30 years ago, there hasn't been much innovation in the overnight space. In sum, these guys are sticking their chins out, and the biggest stone fist is headed their way. DHL, UPS, and FedEx are worth a combined $120 billion. Much of this value will leak to Amazon over the next decade, as consumers trust Amazon more, and the Seattle firm can boast the largest shipper in the United States and Europe, itself, as its first client. Alexa, how can we kill brands? Amazon's voice technology, Alexa, may shake the ground below both retail and brands. Many of my colleagues in academia and business believe that brand building will always be a winning strategy. They're mistaken. Of the 13 firms that have outperformed the S&P 5 years in a row, yes, there's just 13, only one of them is a consumer brand, Under Armour. Note, it will be off next year's list. Creative execs at ad agencies and brand managers at consumer firms may soon decide to spend more time with their families. The sun has passed midday on the brand era. Brands are shorthand for a set of associations that consumers use for guidance toward the right product. Consumer packaged goods, CPG, brands like Tide and Coke have spent billions and decades building brand via messaging, packaging, store placement, price, and merchandising efforts. But when shopping habits migrate online, the design and feel of a product matter much less. There is no visual merchandising. No end caps with carefully displayed products. Voice even further circumvents brand attributes that brands have spent generations and billions to build. With voice, consumers don't know the price or see the packaging and are less likely to include the brand in their request. Fewer and fewer searches contain a brand name. Consumers are willing to price compare several brands, and Amazon gives them just that opportunity. The death of brand at the hand of Amazon, and in particular Alexa, can be foreshadowed in search queries. At L2, we have run tests, by which I mean barking commands at Alexa, to glean insight into Amazon's strategy. Some findings. It's clear that Amazon wants to drive commerce through Alexa, as they are offering a lower price on many products if ordered via voice versus click. In key categories like batteries, Alexa will suggest Amazon Basics, their private label, and play dumb about other choices. Sorry, that's all I found, when there are several other brands on Amazon.com. Though Amazon carries several brands of batteries, its private label, Amazon Basics, accounts for a third of all battery sales online. Retailers often leverage their power and custody of the consumer to swap out brands for their own private label. That's nothing new. Only we've never seen any retailer this good at it. Amazon, armed with infinite capital provided by eager investors, is leading a war on brands to starch the margin from brands and deliver it back to the consumer. Death for brands has a name. Alexa. Amazon the Destroyer. I spoke the following morning after Jeff Bezos at a recent conference. Similar to the kid who sees dead people in The Sixth Sense, Jeff Bezos sees the future of business better than most CEOs. When asked about job destruction and what it would mean for our society, he suggested one more time that we should consider adopting a universal minimum income. Or, he added, a negative income tax where every citizen is granted a cash payment that will be sufficient to stay above the poverty line. People fawned. What a great man, so concerned about the little guy. But wait. Ever notice that there are very few pictures of the inside of an Amazon warehouse? Why is that? Because the inside of an Amazon warehouse is upsetting, even disturbing. Unsafe working conditions? Nope. Abuse of employees, as per the New York Times article? No. What's disturbing is the absence of abuse, or, more specifically, the absence of people. The reason Jeff Bezos is advocating a guaranteed income for Americans is he has seen the future of work and, at least in his vision, it doesn't involve jobs for human beings. At least, not enough of them to sustain the current workforce. Increasingly, robots will perform many of the functions of human employees almost as well, and sometimes a lot better, without annoying requests to leave early to pick their kid up from karate. Amazon doesn't talk publicly about robotics, one of its core competencies, as it realizes it would soon be fodder for late-night hosts and blustery political candidates. In 2012, Amazon quietly acquired Kiva Systems, a sophisticated warehouse robotics firm, for $775 million. In Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi feels a dramatic disturbance in the Force when the Imperial Army turns the Death Star on Alderaan and destroys the planet. When the acquisition of Kiva closed, every union member should have felt a similar disturbance. Entrepreneurs create jobs, right? No, they don't. Most entrepreneurs, at least in tech, leverage processing power and bandwidth to destroy jobs by offering more for less. Amazon grew its revenues $29 billion in 2016 in a retail environment where growth is essentially flat. If you take the number of people Amazon needs to do $1 million in revenue versus the number of people Macy's would need, as Macy's is a decent proxy for retail productivity across the sector, it is, in fact, more productive than most retailers, then it's reasonable to say that Amazon's growth will result in the destruction of 76,000 retail jobs this year. Imagine filling up the largest stadium in the NFL, Cowboy Stadium, with merchandisers, cashiers, sales associates, e-commerce managers, security guards, and letting them know that, courtesy of Amazon, their services are no longer needed. Then, be sure to reserve Cowboy Stadium and Madison Square Garden next year, as it's only going to get worse. Or better if you are Amazon shareholders. Amazon isn't unique among the four in this regard. All do more with less, and all put people out of work. My first reaction to Bezos' speech was, how refreshing to hear a CEO who didn't quote Ayn Rand. However, as I thought further, I realized that Bezos' words were terrifying. Or just resigned. The guy who has the greatest insight and influence into the future of the world's largest business, consumer retail, has come to the conclusion that there's no way the economy will be able to create, as it has done in the past, enough jobs to replace those being destroyed. Perhaps our society has just given up and doesn't want the burden of trying to figure out how to sustain a middle class. Ponder that and ask, will my kids have a better life than me? World domination. Amazon's path to a trillion likely involves a combination of extension into other parts of the retail value chain and further acquisition. Amazon recently announced it was leasing 20 Boeing 757s, purchasing tractor trailers, and getting into shipping. The doubling of the company's stock in the last 18 months and the halving of the value of many competing retail stocks, including Macy's and Carrefour, make acquisition an appealing way to add scale and force relationships with brands that have refused to work with them, any luxury brand. The Whole Foods acquisition allows it to establish a foothold in grocery and acquire a few hundred intelligent warehouses currently posing as stores. Amazon's $434 billion market cap means the Seattle firm could pay, as of April 2016, a 50% premium to acquire the outstanding shares of Macy's, $8 billion market cap, and Carrefour, $16 billion, and still only incur an 8% dilution to its own shareholders. One can only guess what the U.S. Justice Department would say, but my guess is that it would be happy to make the American economy even more competitive. And the shareholders of Macy's and Carrefour would probably breathe a sigh of relief. Or, better yet, Amazon could perfect the cashless checkout technology they're working on with Amazon Go, get the media world hot and bothered, and increase the value of the firm by $10 billion. That would be enough to make this, or several other crazy ideas, a reality by throwing cash at it courtesy of the markets, which reward Amazon and punish the rest of retail as they gaze adoringly at the best storyteller of our age, sans maybe Steven Spielberg, Jeff Bezos. To be fair, Bezos is delivering on his vision to dominate global retail, and then to own the infrastructure that most consumer businesses will pay a toll to access. European retail growth in 2017 will be 1.6%. In 2018, it will be 1.2%. Amazon is the top online retailer in Europe, with sales of 21 billion euro in 2015, which beats the next bestsellers, Otto Group and Tesco, by 3 and 5 times, respectively. But the real disruption will occur when Amazon opens stores throughout the rest of the world, as it's planning to in India. People may love Amazon's selections, prices, and the convenience of buying online, but the number one influencer on consumer decisions is still the store. People love to go into stores and feel things. Real, traditional gatherer. This is especially true in grocery, where the instinct first developed. The grocery sector, ripe, certainly, to be disrupted, will see Amazon apply its tech expertise to store logistics, checkout, and delivery, setting new standards in the sector. Whole Foods had been criticized, and its stock price had fallen pre-acquisition because of its high prices. Amazon will have just the cure for that. Meanwhile, the 460 Whole Foods stores become Amazon's supply chain, a delivery hub for Amazon Fresh, and a transit hub for its other operations. Whole Foods stores could also become locations for returning online orders of any kind, drastically cutting costs. Amazon wants to be within an hour of as many people as possible, and Whole Foods is a recipe for that. Imagine if, in the United States, Amazon bought the post office or a gasoline station company. People are used to bombing in and out of these venues to pick up stuff. It's currently building just such click-and-collect stores in Sunnyvale and San Carlos, both in Silicon Valley. That will send a message. Amazon now offers everything you need before you need it, delivered in an hour to the 500 million wealthiest households on the planet. Every consumer firm paying a toll to access an infrastructure less expensive to rent from Amazon than to build itself. And nobody has the scale, trust, cheap capital, or robots to compete. All supported by an annual payment that includes all sorts of fun stuff, including movies, music, and live streams of NFL games. My bet is Amazon buys the rights to broadcast March Madness or the Super Bowl to juice their Prime membership. As they can. Race to a trillion. The circle is now complete. Amazon now has all the pieces in place for zero-click ordering. AI, purchase history, warehouses within 20 miles of 45% of the U.S. population, millions of SKUs, voice receptors in the wealthiest American households, Alexa, ownership of the largest cloud or big data service, 460, soon thousands, brick-and-mortar stores, and the world's most trusted consumer brand. That is why Amazon will be the first $1 trillion market cap company. Now, you may ask, what about Apple and Uber? Since 2008, those two companies have created more shareholder value than any other public or private firm. The key to their success was the iPhone and GPS ordering and tracking. And that's very different from Amazon's strategy, right? Wrong. Their secret sauce was much more mundane. Breakthrough stores for Apple and reduced friction for Uber. It's not the GPS tracking illuminating where Javier and his Lincoln MKS are, but your ability to bomb out of the car or store without the friction of paying. That puts both companies on the same playing field as Amazon. And Amazon knows the rules of that game far better than the other two companies. As Bezos said in his recent letter to stockholders, "At Amazon, we've been engaged in the practical application of machine learning for many years now." How many years? If Amazon tests an AI-like offering anticipating all your retail needs, sending stuff automatically and calibrating based on what you send back or edit via voice, "Alexa, more Rogaine and less sunblock," the test will register an Amazonian increase in spending per household. The stock will become anti-gravity matter and triple to $1 trillion in value. Facebook and Google own media. Apple owns the phone. And Amazon is about to molest the entire retail ecosystem. Some big-ass losers here. Retail is a much, much bigger business than media or telco, and Amazon's triumph will mean a lot of losers, not just individual companies, but entire industry sectors. Grocery. Obviously, grocery is one of those doomed sectors. It had it coming. This, the largest consumer sector in America, $800 billion, has been where innovation goes to die. Same bad lighting, same depressed workforce, same impossibly frustrating experience in finding my Chobani yogurt as I search from aisle to aisle. Amazon instead offers an online grocery solution with Amazon Fresh and cashierless grocery shopping with Amazon Go, which debuted in December 2016. In June 2017, Amazon acquired 460 stores in wealthy neighborhoods by way of Whole Foods. While Amazon and Whole Foods account for only 3.5% of U.S. grocery spending, the cocktail of high-end grocery and high-tech delivery solutions bodes a significant disruption in the sector. On the day the acquisition was announced, Kroger stock was down 9.24%. United Natural Foods, an organic distributor, was down 11%, and Target 8%. Amazon will eat a lot of lunches. Restaurants will suffer too, as meal prep at home will be made easier by lightning-fast delivery. And yes, delivery services will take a hit, like Instacart, whose spokesperson said that with the Whole Foods acquisition, Amazon had declared war on every supermarket and corner store in America. Walmart. The biggest loser? Easy, Walmart. Walmart's e-commerce growth hurdle reaches beyond Seattle, a workforce that's both underpaid and lacking the skills to close the multi-channel circle. Many of their customers are that group you've wondered about, who don't have broadband or a smartphone. The wealthiest man in the 20th century mastered the art of minimum wage employees selling you stuff. The wealthiest man of the 21st century is mastering the science of zero-wage robots selling you stuff. The same day that Amazon bought Whole Foods, Walmart bought Bonobos, an online menswear retailer that had acquired brick-and-mortar stores. Bonobos has a strong multi-channel model. Customers are fitted on site, and clothes are later mailed. Similar to the Jet acquisition, Walmart hopes to derive e-commerce ethos from the smaller retailer so as to compete against Amazon. Unlikely that Bonobos will make much of a difference given the scale of the juggernaut. Walmart is the largest grocery retailer in the United States, and the Whole Foods acquisition is a major escalation in its grocery wars with Amazon. Walmart has 10 times the number of grocery stores than Whole Foods, but Amazon's logistics are likely to outsmart it. Even Google is getting Amazoned. Google is, relatively speaking, losing to Amazon. Amazon is Google's largest customer and is better at optimizing search than Google is at optimizing Amazon. Not to say that Google isn't an amazing company, but the good money is on Amazon to beat Google in the race to a trillion. Searches for product are lucrative. They get healthy bids, as there may be a purchase at the end of it, versus stalking your high school crush. Amazon's search franchise may rival Google's in value someday, as the people looking to spend start their search at Amazon. But the real victim is traditional retail, whose only growth channel, online, is sunsetting at the hands of Amazon. Each year, Google and brand.coms lose product search volume to Amazon, 6 to 12% for retailers for 2015 to 2016. Conventional thinking is that consumers are researching on brand sites, then going to Amazon to buy. In reality, 55% of product searches start on Amazon, versus 28% on search engines such as Google. This shifts the power and margin from Google and retailers to Amazon. Other losers. The unremarkable. I was a remarkably unremarkable kid. I had mediocre grades, but didn't test well either. In high school, I worked as a box boy at the Westward Ho in Westwood, California, and made about $4 an hour. During my freshman year at UCLA, I got a job, again as a box boy, this time at Vicente Foods in Brentwood. However, this time, as a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union Local 770, my $13 an hour salary paid for my $1,350 a year in-state tuition, and then some. Vicente Foods is still there, so it doesn't appear that the 200% wage premium that put me through school put Vicente Foods out of business. In 1984, it was possible to be a remarkably unremarkable kid with a part-time job and pay your way through a Tier 1 university. Things have changed a lot, and for kids like my younger self, not for the better. Amazon, good or bad, and the other innovators we worship are making it the best of times for the remarkable and the worst for the unremarkable. there will be grocery stores and box boys, just fewer of them. Like the rest of retail, grocery will bifurcate into scale stores with robots giving you 90% of a great store for 60% of the price, using robotics, cheap capital, software, and voice. These will be stores where the employees are experts and serve the wealthy. This is our current retail ecosystem. How many of these jobs are likely going to be replaced by more efficient, cost-effective robots? Ask Amazon. So, is every retailer and its employees screwed? The short answer is no. There is a rebel force of innovative retailers out there who are fighting the empire. Sephora, Home Depot, and Best Buy, to name a few. These firms are zigging as Amazon zags and investing in people. Beauty associates, blue shirts, geek squads, and gold canvas aprons. They couple this investment in human capital with a deft investment in technology. Consumers no longer go to stores for products, which are easier to get from Amazon. They go to stores for people or experts. Will their strategy, or Amazon's, eventually emerge victorious? Or will they somehow accommodate each other and carve out a separate piece? The answer will not only decide the fate of companies, but millions of workers and households as well. What's clear is that we need business leaders who envision and enact a future with more jobs, not billionaires who want the government to fund, with taxes they avoid, social programs for people to sit on their couches and watch Netflix all day. Jeff, show some real fucking vision. Chapter 3. Apple. In December 2015, in San Bernardino, California, a 28-year-old health inspector and his wife